Point of View,
Monday to Thursday, 8 to 10 p.m.
Kick it off with the wrap up the news of the day. Sanusha Naidi is political analyst on the line with us. Sanusha, good evening and thank you so much for being with us.
Good evening, Tim. Lovely to be in the show again. Hope you're well.
So, Sanusha, overnight, obviously, everybody was talking about Arthur Fraser. He was trending. He was all over the place. And I've noticed how everybody's talking about what he said about medical parole, Jacob Zuma's medical parole. There are other things that were in that conversation, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it was about the medical parole, it was about that, but it's also about the state security agency, just how it operates, you know, and you've seen the way in which the president had announced the move of the state security agency as a ministry outside, as an independent ministry, to now be part of the presidency. Mm. And I think that kind of raises the question about what level of authority do the individuals that are in that state security agency operate at, and at what level are they given complete mandate to do what they are supposed to do, and whether or not this is supposed to be under some national security interest that is not supposed to be declassified and in the public domain. But then, of course, you know, can they just operate on a mandate, on a framework, or even a mainframe that is completely not in sync with what the national interest is? Or is it because it's in the national interest they operate in that kind of shadowy space that we always see?
So Sanusha, what's your school of thought? Because people are split on this, you know, that it's not supposed to be under the presidency. Others are saying, well, in fact, because it is about state security, it should be. So where do you stand on this one?
For me, it actually fits within the global narrative of how state security agencies have essentially been part of the establishment of the presidency. We may not call it the kind of state security agency that you think about it, but a couple of weeks ago, Moshik was on a Twitter space, and his argument was the same as the former Minister of State Security, Rodney Kasparov, suggesting that it forms part of a global context, that it's not out of sync. I think the problem for us in South Africa is that this agency had operated in the wild, wild west for far too long. Mm-hmm. It operated on its own mandate, its own frameworks, its own kind of mainframe of how it was populated. And it allowed, to a large extent, not to say South Africa is an exception, but definitely the rogue element became quite pivotal in this agency, in terms of what we are now seeing in the context of some of the declassified and some of the issues that are coming to the fold and being opened up. But again, the question is, if you're going to move it into the presidency, you've got to be 100% sure that you've got your finger on the pulse with these individuals and how they are operating. And I think that, for me, is the question of, you know, the challenge is, do you put everything in the public domain? Are there certain things that need to be done in a manner that is behind the scenes and cannot be part of the public domain because of the national security interest that it serves? But at the end of the day, this has been manipulated. And it's not just a South African problem. It is a global problem. We know that these institutions operate as if they are a law unto themselves.
Yes. But you also have to be quite wary of the type of president that you have. So this, unfortunately, is not specifically about a Cyril Ramaphosa, for instance. It's the power that it gives to a sitting president that I'm concerned about, knowing that we're not likely to have a perfect president. And those power dynamics and how far do they go, and how much power one individual actually sits with. Yeah.
Can I flip it around, Pam, and raise that same question in terms of how much of power it gave President Zuma? And it wasn't in the presidency.
Ah, I see what you mean. So in other words, it's also quite easy to exactly. be hands off and still wield the power and look like you actually have nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I think about how when President Zuma came into office, you know, one of the things that really astounds me about the intelligence architecture was how it was populated, how the architecture was constructed around how important it became to where you use the different people to play out your political game. And I think that is the flip question for me, is you've got to have a control. You've got to make sure that there is a pulse point around whether or not, is it giving too much of power to the president if it's in the presidency, but then it also can operate outside of the presidency and still have power to the president.
So then, because anyway, the nature of state security is that it's in the shadows, right? Then how do we then hold whoever accountable for what happens in there?
If you have the answer to that, I think the whole world wants you to give them that crystal ball reflection, because this is the dilemma in the global intelligence community.
Yeah.
I mean, I think now we're beginning to see with WikiLeaks and other kind of declassification of information, where we've heard particular tapes that were basically made public, and you know we know about Julian Assange and all of that issues. The point is that the spooks always operated as spooks.
Mm.
They always operated in the shadow world, and how that shadow world looked. I mean, yes, you know, James Bond makes it look glamorous, but it's not glamorous.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, I think that's the challenge for any government. Is how much of power they have unto themselves, whether in the presidency, outside the presidency. I mean, let me end on this point. The famous FBI head, what was his name? J. Edgar Hoover.
Mm-hmm.
He had dirt on everybody.
So, I mean, and as he should, because that's exactly his job, right? So the question then I have, you've just said spooks always work in the shadows, which is true. Yes, Arthur Fraser has about 2 weeks to go, and that's it for him in government. I want to ask you this. Why do you think he did the interview?
I think it was his parting shot. I think it was to say, you know what? I have power. I still have influence. I still can make this happen. And some of the parts of his interview was a bit sketchy in detail. I don't know, somewhere in the beginning of August there was this report. Oh, yeah, if you want, it's all legal and procedural. Yes, it's in the documentation. Yes, we present it to Parliament. It's that kind of, you know, I think it's also the idea to show that he's not leaving on a limping foot.
Mm.
He's leaving with the idea that I made this happen.
Mm. Look, I mean, he came across as quite confident in parts, and that was also quite clear. And this is interesting also because we didn't see him at State Capture, even though his name came up all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right. And I think that, you know, as we normally say, that there were those that needed to appear before the Zondo Commission that did not appear.
Mm.
Remember, there were those two witnesses in terms of what was happening in the state security agency.
Mm-hmm.
They were giving evidence as whistleblowers, and their identity had to be protected.
Mm.
But this is the world that we have to understand. You know, at the end of the day, it's also about how information is used and for what purpose and what intended outcome.
President Cyril Ramaphosa has warned the ANC internally, saying that it's going to be explosive. The report that comes out of the State Capture Commission is going to be explosive and it's going to have consequences. I'm disappointed that I never got to hear from Arthur Fraser, because his name was bandied around a lot.
Yes, yes. And very much part of that whole understanding of what was happening in the architecture, in the actual labyrinth of the state security agency, who was doing what, who knew what,
yes,
how they were moving things, what information flow was happening. And of course, the question is, you know, can there be a kind of information gathering around how much he knew, how much he was involved in, and what was his engagement in all of this? So I think at the end of the day, like you, we want to know more about the state security architecture and what role it played in State Capture, because if you remember correctly, the state security agency also had a few very big robberies of money that went kind of very interestingly walked out of the front door.
Yes. And so then that brings me to the question about the State Capture Commission and how comprehensive do you think the final report will be with the kind of gaps that you and I have just identified?
I think it's going to try and be as comprehensive as it can, but there are going to be gaping holes, particularly on the issue of whether or not information can be divulged in terms of the state security agency. Remember, we also have the Promotion of Access to Information Act. So whether or not you can apply, and whether or not civil society will apply to say that, you know what, we want to make this information declassified. and in the public domain.
Yeah, but I mean, so in the same way that as media, you've also got to be responsible about giving someone the right to reply. And I don't necessarily think that all the information must be declassified, but I do expect that if everybody points a finger at one individual, surely we should be getting some response from that individual.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And I think that that individual is carrying a lot in their vault. And so there's a lot of stuff that they're carrying, which will in many ways have a lot of interesting, I don't know, you know, do these people sleep well? Do they sleep? Do they have sleepless nights about what they know and what they have done and all of that stuff? It's a very interesting point to raise. But I think in the final state capture report, I think there's going to be definitely avenues that will possibly, we will probably need to understand what the recommendation would be by Acting Chief Justice Zondo in terms of going forward where there are gaps that need to be filled in.
So then do you think the fact that he didn't appear was deliberately not to expose some of the stuff that he knows, that vault that you speak of?
I think the only person that can answer that is himself.
No, is it really? Or is it the head of the commission? Because he was supposed to ask him to come, right?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you in terms of the technical issue. Mm-hmm. Should he have asked him, should he have got him to say, well, you need to come and appear? Is it to compel him to appear, or was it voluntary? I mean, there's so many other things that go in this. Was it a time constraint? Was there something there that said, you know what, we can't afford to ask him because maybe there's this issue about national security. Yeah. You know, there's so many things here that we need to understand. And I think there definitely needs to be a legal opinion or a legal perspective on whether or not the commissioner, the head of the commission, would actually have the kind of leverage to say to Mr. Arthur Fraser, I want you to appear before the commission.
Okay, so let's talk about what we do know, which is at least the fact that he very squarely and clearly said, look, no, I decided that President Jacob Zuma needs to go home. I am the one who made that decision, and I was with, I had every right to do that. The law allows me to do that, and everything is above board.
I think just the mere language of I tells you what he was trying to convey as how much power he has and how much he has the final say in the decision on that medical parole. And I think that is where we have to be careful of how these individuals become powers unto themselves.
But surely the DA, for instance, knew that there is that provision in the Act. The Medical Parole Board merely gives a recommendation. They don't make the final say. And everybody should have known this before we were all up in arms about the fact that the Medical Parole Board did or did not recommend for him to go home. Because actually it's just that, a recommendation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm completely agreeing with you this evening. I completely think that sometimes we get caught up more in the fact that the person needs to stay there because we believe that that's the reason, and the technicalities of it somehow get overlooked.
Yep.
And completely, you know, what really disappointed me was some of the reasoning that was given in that interview. Oh, this was a man with comorbidities. He was very ill. I mean, if I remember correctly, about 2 or 3 days before he handed himself off to the escort correctional services, Mr. Zuma gave an interview at his in Kanjla home. And in there, somebody, a journalist asked him, you know, have you taken the vaccine? He said, no, I didn't take the vaccine for COVID-19. And the impression one got was he didn't have any comorbidities. So maybe I'm just misinterpreting this. But again, the question for me is when he gets there and suddenly all of these things start emerging, you know, and he's an exception to the rule.
Listen, it sounds like an absolute movie. I would go watch this movie if this was... I would definitely go watch this movie. Let's move on to Action SA. They launched their campaign, election campaign today. Herman Mashaba says he's got unfinished business in the city. Are you convinced?
Well, Herman Mashaba is convinced. I read a bit of his election manifesto launch today. He's a very confident individual, and I guess that's what you need to have in politics today, thick skin and confidence. And I was intrigued by the number of municipalities, or rather the four metros and the two district councils that he's going to be contesting. I think the four metros are Elukhuleni, Johannesburg, eThekwini, and Tshwane, and then, of course, Newcastle and KwaZulu-Natal. And I was interested to understand why those two in KZN and then, of course, the four metros. But he seems to be confident that they're going to win all, and he's even open to the possibility of a coalition, but not for the ANC. So,
yeah, but I mean, when you look at
the ANC, then what about the EFF? You know, he hasn't said anything there.
So when you look at, for instance, Tshwane, it's a low-hanging fruit. And he's possibly right in the sense that many of these are weak as we speak. He obviously has history with Johannesburg. And so he says, you know, he'd be happy to come back into Johannesburg. But I think he's got a fighting chance. I don't know what you think, particularly if it's a coalition government that's going to be
fighting. Yeah, no, on the coalition side, definitely. And of course, in the case of Johannesburg, I think it's also for him to come back not as the mayor that was forced to resign or felt that he needed to resign, but to come back and play out what he felt was his mandate as mayor. Mm. So to come back into that metro. I think on the basis of low-hanging fruit as well in Tshwane, it'll be interesting to see whether or not, you know, who the coalition partner is. Mm. If he's not willing to go with the ANC, that you go with the DA despite his experience with them. And then, of course, there's the EFF. There's all of these. And do the smaller political parties then give him enough to hold a coalition in there to be able to have a coalition, outcome for his party to be in power or a coalition in terms of how he sees it? I think what's also important is voter turnout. In the
but, Sanusha, we've heard this before. We've heard the politicking before where one political party grandstands and says, I will not go into, you know, bed with this particular political party. And then later on, everything changed. And then suddenly they were making, you know, they were having a wedding together. So I don't know about this. I will not go into a coalition with one or the other. I'm not convinced. I think when it comes to crunch time, we will then have to see.
Well, let me put it to you in one word, expediency, right? Mm. You got to think about, you know, how do I want to, what is it that I want?
Position myself.
I want power.
Yeah.
I want to be there. It's my vested interest. And I think that's the problem. The problem is, and I remember years ago, you know, when the minority front had two seats in KZN and they went into a very broad coalition, not a broad coalition, even just gave their two seats to the ANC. And the late Mr. Rajiv Bansi made a very interesting comment. They said, but you were part of the tricameral parliament in the apartheid state. And he said, no, the ANC and I will cross those double bridges and they need my vote. They need my two seats.
And we've seen it with the EFF, for instance, and the DA, where policies are stark in difference, but they have in places had a coalition. So when you speak about, for instance, land invasions, and when you speak about private property, those kind of policies are opposite poles of one ruler. And still, when it came to crunch time, people kind of found a way to work together.
So the question then is, does ideology play a role? Or do they feel that they can work together, but they can be a kind of like, we work together, but we can actually be different when we need to vote on policy. Now, the problem with these coalitions, again, is that, as you say, it's a marriage. It's a marriage of expediency. It's a marriage of, oh, I want to get into that space. But it's also about, you know, the political dynamics. It's about, I want to be in power. And I think at the end of the day, it becomes very messy because the people you take in with your coalition are not always on the same page when it comes to policy. That's why you have these chaotic scenes in metros and in local government municipalities.
So can you imagine Herman Mashaba, who has reiterated that him and foreign nationals are not going to be, you know, having a nice conversation, and then the EFF says, no, open up the borders. Can you imagine that relationship in Johannesburg, where we have an influx of foreign nationals?
Those statements made me cringe a bit because it was very explicit in the position that he was taking. And I think he's very clear about that this is not going to be allowing illegal immigrants, whether they're economic migrants or whatever, coming in and not creating jobs and employment creation for South African locals. He said South Africa is not a employment agency for people from the outside, and you will not let other countries determine the policy on immigration. And I think at the end of the day, that's going to be a bit of, I think that's grandstanding, but it's also the way you want to attract the electorate through these popular statements.
Mm. Sanusha Naidu, thank you so much for your time. Political analyst, just going through what made headlines today.
Point of View, Monday to Thursday, 8 to 10 p.m.